how is the colony, like you said that your dad bought a colony farm. So how did the colony, did they like different people moving into the community, or did it become really isolated and closed off itself, or was it pretty permeable that way?
Well, initially, the colonists, you know, they signed a contract mm-hmm. for their land, and the ARC dictated, you know, what you could do and so on. And if you, the initial contract changed over time, but initially, ARC had to approve, if you were going to sell your land, they had to approve that, because they wanted it to stay in the colony. You couldn't be just selling it off to anybody. Well, there was a lot of resistance to a lot of the controls that the government had on the colony, and so some of that relaxed over time. And by the time we came back, you could sell your farm. I don't know what the restrictions were. Mm-hmm. Probably it had to go to a farmer to, you know, was going to farm it. You couldn't right. sell it off to a realtor or something. But, a lot of controls, and that was a source of quite a bit of friction and conflict. Somebody said, farmers don't make very good communists. You know, they rebel at being told how to do anything. And so things changed over time, and the controls relaxed.
Right. Yeah. Jumping ahead to where you became the school teacher in Tannenhaus, is that what you said?
Tannenhaus. Yeah.
So, that must have been quite the experience to go up
into what. It was quite an experience, yeah. We showed up and landed at the airstrip and hitched a ride down to the school. The other teachers were having a meeting, and they were deciding what they were going to teach and getting all that organized. And we walked in and introduced ourselves, and so sat down. Here's what you're going to teach. Here's what you're going to teach. And we didn't have a place to live. You know, we'd just been there 2 hours, and school was going to start, you know, 2 more hours from now. So my assignment was I had a homeroom 7th and 8th grade combined, and I was teaching them social studies. One had there was reading for both of them. One of them had history, and the other had geography, maybe, or something, and physical education. So that was for that group. And we had a high school there, all 12 grades. And so freshman, I think I taught geography. Sophomores was history, U.S. history, and second term world history, I think. Juniors was economics and, I don't know, something else for the seniors. And there you are. Here are the books, and here's your class, and go to it. Well, so we got past the first afternoon by calling roll and handing out books, you know. And then that evening, the principal found a mattress and put in the teacher's lounge. The school was a modern building, state building. It had a nice teacher's lounge with a little kitchenette, you know. So we put mattress in there, and we lived in that teacher lounge for the first month or more, I guess, which was interesting because you fry bacon for breakfast and the whole school smelled like bacon, you know.
They didn't have teachers' quarters at that time?
Well, there were teachers' quarters in the school that the principal and his wife both taught. They lived in a little apartment there off the school. The other couple had a trailer house parked right behind the school they lived in. The single man had a little apartment over with the hospital. The town was in three parts. There was the village, the native village, yeah, with the school and the stores. There were two stores, NC Company and Gregory's trading post were there. Then there was the hospital, the regional hospital. And then the FAA up at the other end with the airstrip, mm-hmm, and stuff up there, the compound up there. And that was it. And in the village, there was no housing. There were all little cabins, you know. The school furnished, they didn't furnish anything other than the apartment and the school. I think the other couple owned that trailer, and the other man was renting the apartment from the hospital. So we lived there in the teacher's lounge for, it was a good month. And then they found a duplex apartment up with the FAA. And so we were able to move into that, and that was very nice. Mm-hmm. It was a very modern upstairs apartment duplex. And it worked out very well.
How large was the town at that time then? How population-wise? I mean, to have a hospital and everything.
Well, it was a regional hospital.
So all the Bush communities would have come into that hospital then.
Yeah.
Right.
And they did regularly. It was staffed by Navy doctors, and they had a dentist and some nurses there. And because it was a regional hub, kind of, the FAA compound was staffed around the clock. They had controllers, mm-hmm, there.
So 500 people, maybe?
Yeah, I think about 400.
400,
yeah.
And how large were your class sizes? And I take it they were mostly Native kids?
Mostly Native students, yeah. But there were some white folks. The Gregory's were half Native, and the mother was Eskimo. Mm-hmm. And then some of the folks from the FAA were all Caucasian,
yeah,
folks, so some of them had kids in class. But it was a real mix. Most of the Native kids had never been even to Fairbanks. Mm. And so here we were trying to teach these kids economics, you know, and world geography and stuff, and they didn't even know what Fairbanks was like. And that was a real challenge. And the books, of course, were standard texts, and it didn't take me very long to get rid of those and tailor something else. I never got into trouble for doing that, but, you know, the economic text was talking about the stock market and, you know, and banking and all kinds of stuff, and I thought, you know, what these kids need to learn first is how to make an order out of Sears catalog, you know, and maybe how to write a check, and how to go to the store and compare shopping, stuff like that, you know, basic stuff. And so that's kind of what we did. We
life skills.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that was the economics course. and geography or current events had very little resources to do that. I mean, there was no TV and computer and stuff like that in those days. We had radio, and that was about the only way you got anything from outside. So I had a subscription to Life magazine, and I'd bring that in and use that as current events kind of things. And we had I had National Geographic coming in, and I had standard school broadcast records. Back in those days, Standard Oil Company produced big 33 and a third records of various history and natural history and current events kinds of programs, and you could order those. They'd send them to you, and you could keep them for, I don't know, 2 weeks or something, and then you send them back, they send you a new one, and they had good stuff on there. It was high quality programs. They'd have like FDR's speech, "There is nothing to fear but fear itself," you know. You could hear the voice, and Churchill making his talking about blood, tear and sweat, you know. And then they had recreations of historical events and Lincoln making his speech and so on. So it was a great resource, and the kids loved it, because on Friday afternoon, when they were really wanting to get out of there, I'd play these programs, and it was cool. They enjoyed them. They listened to them. The interesting one interesting thing about that, three sections of town, each one had their own power plant. So the power plant up at the FAA station, that was government. It was well maintained. They had to keep the lights on and, you know, and talking to the airplanes and stuff. So that was a good system. One at the hospital, that was a good system too, because they had to keep the hospital going. The one at the village was operated by a man that had a bit of a drinking problem, and he tended to fall asleep and not maintain the power plant all that well, and so the school was on that one, and so the power would fluctuate. And here I'd be playing this record, you know, and somebody'd be making a speech, and he was making a speech, and then all of a sudden he's talking like this. And so I'd have speeded up to 45, you know, getting back up there talking like this, and then the power would come back up, and I'd just slow it back down again, and the kids just thought that was a hoot, you know. It was great.
So the social problems were already in the village when you were there?
Oh, yeah, any community has social problems, you know. But the thing that struck me was, here are these kids, this first term, first half of the year, here are these kids in the village, and they're naive, you know, they're just, many of them mischievous, but they weren't mean, bad kids. Their idea of really doing something bad was rolling oil barrels out into the street and leaving them there. So, you know, that was that was okay. I thought that was kind of cool. The second term, there was half a dozen kids that had left the village prior, high school kids, and gone to Fairbanks to go to school. And some of those came back really polluted. You know, they had experienced the wider world and not benefited from it. And so they were kind of mean. I mean, their ideas of getting into trouble were getting into trouble. And I thought that was a very interesting situation there. The other problems, drinking was a big problem.
It wasn't a dry community then?
No.
They allowed alcohol to come in.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't think it was. I don't think there was even an attempt to make it dry. But there was booze, and all of the negative impacts on a community were there because of that domestic strife and loss of income.
Mm-hmm.
People would get together, they'd get some booze, they'd get together and have a party. All the booze would be gone, and they'd want something else to drink, and so they'd kind of get the change out of their pockets. They'd pool the money and get enough to hire an airplane to fly over to Manly, where there was a liquor store. There wasn't a liquor store in Tannenhoek, but fly to Manly and buy a bottle, or whatever they managed to get together, maybe two bottles if they were really lucky, to fly back and drink that up. And once that was gone, you know, if they were still standing up, they'd come up with some more money, you know, and try to do it again. So there was a tremendous economic impact on. There wasn't all that much money in the community to begin with, you know. There wasn't industry there. A few people worked at the FAA station as maintenance people or at the hospital, but there wasn't very many people doing that. The others were on welfare, make a little money in the summertime doing something, fishing or off to construction or something. But booze was a real problem. That was the biggest problem, I think, in the community. Another kind of interesting situation. Gregory's store had been the old jail. Well, let me back up a little farther. In the old days, Tannenhoek, what is now downtown Tannenhoek, was a military fort, Fort Gibbon. The village was up the river farther, and the natives weren't allowed to come in to the town, Fort Gibbon, until smallpox, I think, really hit the village and wiped out many of them, and then they moved down, and the army moved out, and so the town is where it is. Well, the Gregory's trading post was the old...
I'm just checking. Yep, go ahead.
Was the old jail. And so they had taken the bars off of everything, but they stored their goods back in all the cells, you know, the little rooms. Well, one day I was sent to the store to get some vanilla. My wife wanted to make a cake or something. She's out of vanilla extract. So I went down there, and the Gregory girls... I had in my 7th and 8th grade classes, 7th and 8th, and one of them was tending the store, and so I went in. There was a couple of other folks there doing some business, and when they were done, they kind of moved down the counter, and I moved over to talk to Dolly Gregory. I said, "I need some vanilla extract." She's busy down here. was not paying any attention to me, you know. He's busy, busy, busy. Dolly, I need some vanilla extract. And she kind of looked up and she, yeah, okay. Busy, busy, busy. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? Well, then those two people left. She, oh, and Dolly said, okay, I'll get you the vanilla extract. And she went back into the one of these cells, and I kind of followed her back there, and she got a little step ladder, climbed up on it, reached way back behind a box, and got this bottle of vanilla extract, and I took it out there. And so while I'm paying for it, I said, Dolly, what's going on? What's all this about? She said, oh, well, we don't let people know that we have this, because if we did, people would buy it and they'd drink it.
Alcohol.
Because it's got a lot of alcohol in it. So she didn't want to disclose that while those other people were in the store. See? And there were people who would, you know, nobody locked their doors, and so there were a couple of people well known for wandering around in the night and going in and getting into your bathroom while you were asleep, drinking and shaving lotion and stuff. It was really pretty sad. But, you know, interesting people. I just enjoyed them.
And were you just there for the 1 year then, Richard?
Yeah, I just stayed for 1 year. My wife, at the end of that year, she stayed on for the summer to teach a summer program of some kind for the kids. And I went back. I was working summers with the Soil Conservation Service on a crew doing soil survey work in the valley here. So I went and did that. Then we went back outside the fall.
It's tough when the teachers come and go quite often in the communities. And
well, that too was one of the big problems in the bush schools, is that you don't have consistency. You have, first of all, oftentimes you have poor teachers going out there, because those are the only ones who can't find a job somewhere else. And, you know, the kids would tell me stories about teachers in previous years who would give an assignment and then put their head down and go to sleep, you know. Other teachers that would show up drunk. You know, a big reason why those kids didn't get very good education out there to begin with, you know.
So, reflecting back on UAF.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's a school back there.
That's right. Did you enjoy your time there?
I did. Of course, as a freshman, you know, you're free. You get out there, and that's part of the reason I almost flunked out, I think. it was great, because you go there from a society of being a kid, and all of a sudden you're in a university system where big people talk to you, professors and grown-ups, you know, would not only talk to you, they'd listen to you. That was really scary. They ask you a question and they'd listen. You know, nobody ever did that before. And to see all the things that were going on, the Geophysical Institute, you know, real science happening there, doing all kinds of stuff, and then of course there was the basketball and all the activities that kids get into, that college students get into, and
any memorable antics that you remember at all, or is it pretty?
Well, you know, one of the traditions we were told was that the freshman class traditionally stole and hid the, what is it, the foundation stone.
The cornerstone? The cornerstone?
The one that's cemented out there in the, yeah. And so we figured, well, if that's the tradition, we'd better uphold it, you know. And so one of the kids from Fairbanks had a big old car. I think it was a old Hudson, gray Hudson. And so one night, several of us got together, and we found that stone. I don't know where it was, and managed to wrestle it into the trunk of that Hudson and drove off with it, you know, driving like that. And we had it, and now we said, well, what are we going to do with it? You know, here's this thing that weighed, I don't know, 500 pounds or something. And we didn't have a plan. We didn't know where we were going to put it. You know, if you steal something, you got to put it somewhere. And we were driving around. Finally, back on some back road there, we decided, well, this is as good a place as any. And so we dumped it off in the snow and rolled it back in the brush off the road so you couldn't see it. And left. And that was the last I heard of it. Yeah, but somebody apparently squealed as to where it was, and it was recovered, and they brought it back and cemented it in, so that tradition died.
Any repercussions from that?
Oh, no.
No.
Not that I heard of.
Right.
It didn't come get me.
So what do you think UAF gave you for going on in your career and life?
Well, opening up the real world, you know, was a part of it. You know, the classes were interesting. I really struggled in virtually all of them. But having a chance to, you know, explore it, took biology and botany and some of that stuff that I was really interested in, other things that it wasn't. ROTC was really different for me. It was compulsory at that time. I don't know if it still
is. What is ROTC?
Reserve Officer Training Corps. All land-grant colleges had to have ROTC. It was a training ground or a way to get young men, at that time, all men, into the military as leaders, as second lieutenants. Because if you went through 4 years of ROTC, you progressed from a, you know, a private grunt. And then if you were really into it and gung-ho, well, you got promoted. And by the time you graduated, then you could go into the Army or, I don't know, maybe one of the others, and as a second lieutenant. There are other, this was an Army ROTC, there are others, Air Force I think has others maybe. But that was an experience, because we had to have uniforms, we had to learn how to march and take orders and do that. Plus there was a class, a military history class, and taught by a full colonel, and he had a captain. No, let's see. He had a major and a captain and a couple of sergeants there. And one of the sergeants was in charge of the rifle team. When I first went up there, I thought, "Oh yeah, hey, I'd like to be in the rifle team." That was cool. and I wanted to learn how to fly. So I thought, you know, I'll do all that in my spare time. And there was a guy by the name of Don Johns, who was a flying instructor and guy. He was around trying to get interested in forming a flying club. And he would be the instructor and so on. So if you signed up, then you had to pitch in money. And luckily, he didn't get enough people to make that work. And so I didn't get into that.
Did you make it on the rifle team, though?
No. I discovered that I didn't have any spare time. I was just barely keeping my nose above the academic waters. So I didn't take part in much other than the intramural basketball with the dorm team.
Did your dad ever talk about his experience at UAF or his? You're right. It's very unusual at that time for both parents to be college educated.
Well, he did talk about it, and I've gathered together his photographs and letters and stuff there. He didn't talk about it to us kids much, but I heard him talk about it some. I discovered more later as I got into the photographs and stuff. He was, of course, a very small population there, and very informal. They had a dining hall, and the students would quite often furnish the food. They'd go out and shoot caribou or moose or get some ducks or, you know, something and bring it in. That's what they ate. And every one of the students was part of something. He was on the, what do they call it, first aid team, you know, which was as close as they got to EMTs, you know. Mm-hmm. They knew. He had been a Boy Scout. He had been a Eagle Scout, so he had first aid training, and so he was on that. A lot of hunting and stuff. He was on the ROTC. Mm-hmm. He was the ROTC band major. I got a picture of him with his baton. And I remember him telling a story about, I think, the 4th of July parade down Fairbanks, where the ROTC band was marching in the parade, and he was leading the parade, you know, down the street. And he had this baton, and it was a big, long thing, and the one he had had some tassels on one end of it.
Okay.
And he would march along and twirling this thing, and he'd throw it up in the air, you know, and it'd come down, he'd catch it, and then he'd march along, and he pitched it up in the air, and it didn't come down. And he looked up, and these tassels had wrapped around a telephone wire going across the street. And the baton was going around and around and around like that. And he's standing there marching in place, and the band's about ready to walk up his back, you know, and he's thinking, is it going to come down? Is it going to come down? Just in time, it came down. He grabbed it and marched on like it was all part of the parade, you know. It was...
This is a family genealogy.
Well,
book?
What I did, he wrote a bunch of letters back to Indiana, and he collected some pictures and things, and so I just put them all together.
Oh, nice.
And here's a picture of my dad and the two Dickey brothers. They were working one summer there with Otto Geist. in the collection of all the bones and stuff that Geist collected.
Yep.
You know,
and it looks like mastodon's tusks there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
And so, there he is with the first aid crew.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. Yeah.
And the play and some of the people in the dorm.
Right.
It's
what year did he graduate? You said 35? Did you say
34. Let's see. You got 2 degrees. One is in 34, I think. The other was 35. If I can find this.
Did you print up several of these for your family?
Yeah,
very nice.
That's the idea.
Oh, there we go.
Here we are. This one.
36 for that one. That's for the
37.
Bachelor of Science was 36, and 37. Bachelor of Agriculture is 37. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's him and the band.
Nice picture. Yeah.
And the play and the dorm pictures. And other things. And he was quite active in the sports. He had set a broad jump record. There he is.
There's his uniform. The trousers.
And he was on the basketball team.
That's a courthouse, yeah. On the basketball team? Oh, look at the aerial shot of the university, how small it was. 1935.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the farm down there, John, where the botanical gardens are now, the Georgeson Botanical Gardens.
It's actually clear over
here.
Is
it there? That far.
Yeah, see the dorms are down here.
Oh,
here.
My.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, there's a silver cup up there somewhere that's got his name on it.
Up in the university?
Yeah, somewhere.
Yes, sir.
There he is.
On track.
High jumping and broad jumping. Huh. Set a record there and doing that. There's the guy that got him up there, Lynn Smith.
Huh.
Smith was an interesting character. He knew everybody. Well liked by everybody.
Owned a jewelry shop?
Yeah, he was a jeweler. And so that's how he made his living, amongst other things.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Lynn Smith. Anyway, so.
That's lovely. And you said Bunnell's, a letter from Bunnell?
Oh, yeah, let's
too?
See if
we
I can find
see that.
That
you
quick.
Mentioned
I,
it.
There he is as a kid.
Wow, that's lovely. Eagle Scout picture. Now, when did he pass away? Because you said your mom lived to 102.
Yeah, let's see. He died, this was 72, so it was about 76, 7, somewhere in there. Pretty good. Let's see here.
I know that Bunnell had helped a lot of students out financially.
Oh, yeah.
Did he help your dad out, too? Do you know?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Uh-huh.
I think, though, Dad was always working, and so he probably paid his way. You know, they had work on campus for students as well. Bunnell would make work. Yes. They still did that when I was up there, chipping ice off the walks, moving stuff. When they'd move an office, I helped them move stuff out of the basement.
And you get paid for this? Or?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
It's a way for the kids to make a little money.
Mm-hmm.
We were moving stuff out of the basement at Hess Hall, I think it was. Found a whole bunch of old stuff. Found an old cannon down there. Let's see if I can.
Oh, there's Charles E. Bunnell right there.
Yeah.
Well, my dad. To him.
After Dad came down, he was farming over there by Wasilla.
Mm-hmm.
He plowed up an old artifact, an old axe.
Yeah.
And sent it up to Bunnell to put in the museum.
Right.
Let's see here. Yes, here it is. Mr. Howard Stell, my dear Howard, Director Oldroyd has handed to me your letter of June 7th. In my opinion, and under the conditions existing in Alaska, I believe the position for which you are making application demands a married man. 1,000 reasons can be enumerated. For you, I have the highest regard, and I know of no one who possesses to a higher degree some of the essential qualifications for success than yourself. You are very much of the homemaking type and ought to have a home of your own. The position pays enough so you can afford to have a home. I hope you can meet the special qualifications I am insisting upon, not only for your own interests, but in the interests of good administration for this special service. I would not say as much to you as I have said, but I know you so well and have your best interests so much at heart, I trust you will bear with me if it seems to you I have taken too great an interest in your personal affairs. Kindly let me have your reaction to this suggestion at once, for an appointment ought to be made in the near future. I want to recommend you, but I can hardly do so in the face of the policy I think ought to be followed in our work in Alaska for the appointment for which you are seeking application. With best wishes, sincerely, Charles Brunell.
And that's dated June 15th, 1938?
38.
Wow.
So, if you want the job, you got to get married.
Basically. And then you both can't be employed.
Well, that's right.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so my mother, I did the same kind of thing
lovely.
With a lot of
very nice
her family letters from here. So there she
Isn't
is.
Isn't that nice?
I've done another one with a lot of her earlier pictures and so on.
Those women filled a very, very important role in society at the time, the women who, well, what we call home economics today, but they were a real resource in the communities.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even some of the colony kids that I talk to today, they say, oh, Ruth, you know, she taught me so much.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Real life skills, practical skills.
Yeah.
Those are lovely books.
Here she is. You know, one of the activities, or there are many activities here in the colony, at the drop of a hat, an excuse to do something, you know.
Right.
And so they would go out and have picnics. This is a picnic, Homemakers Club picnic, up Hatcher's Pass. They all go up there, have a picnic, and pick berries, you know, in the fall. And then he'd come back and all get together and make jam, you know, stuff like that.
That's so called the Sourdough Homemakers Club.
That was the Sourdough Homemakers Club. There were a number of homemakers clubs around Valley View and Glacier View and various others. But
the sourdough just reminds me of somebody telling me that your daughter has a sourdough batter still from Lola Tilly.
Yeah. This is mother.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the two of them about 1936. You know, they never talked about, to me anyway, how they got together.
Hmm.
or when. But Howard was, you know, he was up at the college, and he came down, I'm sure, a number of times, because this is where the agriculture action was going on. And I have a picture that shows that he was taking care of the bees out at the experiment farm one year. So I'm sure that he and Ruth knew each other as soon as she moved here, and maybe before that, because they have letters where Howard had written to Ruth's father, R.W. DeArmond, who was the judge in Sitka, inquiring about the possibilities of starting a dairy farm in Sitka, and wanting to know, you know, what R.W. thought about that. And my suspicion is that he had been down to Sitka, and so he'd probably met Ruth down there, certainly knew her parents anyway. So there was already a connection, and I think by the time Bunnell wrote his letter, that Howard was able to say, well, hey, this good-looking gal down there, you know, she kind of fancies me, and so you give me the job so I can go down there and you know, we'll make it happen.
Right, you know? Yeah. And, you know, obviously had a strong common interest in agriculture, and, you know, I mean, both working for cooperative extension type thing, so common grounding there. That's really, really interesting. I'm sure, thank you. Anything else that you can think of that we might not have covered?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll think of something, you know,
I'm sure.
After we leave.
Well, thank you. That's been really interesting, and especially the history of the area here. It was really interesting, too.
If you are further interested in the colony story, there is a video that was made several years ago about the Matanuska colony. Okay. And it's really the best telling of that story anywhere.
Hmm. Who made it?
Well, it was made by an independent group, couple, actually, two people. And they came up here, this is, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago when they first started this thing, and did interviews on camera of as many of the colonists that were still alive, that were coherent, and their colony kids that they could find, and other ARRC people that, that worked for the corporation or the co-op, and got their stories. And they put together then a 2-CD disc of those interviews and started selling those to raise money to do the actual movie. They interviewed my mother.
Hmm.
So then they went back to Washington and got into the government files, the ARC files, the other government New Deal files, and the newspaper accounts. You see, this was a big deal, this people coming to Alaska, and so there were a number of newspaper stories about it back home, you know, because their people had gone off. Besides that, one of the newspapers had a reporter here full-time for a while, sending out dispatches. Will Rogers and Wiley Post stopped in here, and the day before they flew off and crashed and died. So it was a big deal. There was a lot of written about it. There was a lot of issues and controversy. Some of the women had written back to Eleanor Roosevelt complaining about problems and so on and so on. So there was a lot of material, And they gathered all that up and took some of the interviews. They interviewed some additional historian folks and put it into a comprehensive story with the interviews, the background information, the documents, and the pictures. And it runs about an hour and a half, I think. And for somebody who's really interested in that story, that's the best.
And what was the name of the film? Do you remember, or do you remember the filmmaker?
Alaska Far Away.
Alaska Far Away.
It's the name of the story, the CD. We sell it here at the Visitor Center. The Colony House Museum down the street sells it as well. It's kind of expensive. I think it's $30-$35 or something.
I wonder if we have one in the library, actually, is what I'm wondering.
You should have if you don't, because it's...
That's what I'm asking, because if we don't have it, next year when we start... they have a huge DVD collection and a lot of historical film up there. So I'll look in the collection and see if it's there, and if it isn't, I'll suggest one of the ones to be purchased.
You should have that, because it's fascinating. We play it here in our fireplace.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that when you came through, but in the fireplace, instead of having a fire, we got this big screen TV in there.
Yeah.
And we play that almost continuously all summer long. Sometimes, if we get kids coming in, we'll play other things, wildlife and stuff. But
Well, while we've got you here, Richard, maybe you can tell us a little bit of the history of the organization here in the museum.
Well, as I mentioned, it's a city visitor center and museum facility and garden associated with it. It's a wonderful garden. It's one of the premier gardens in the valley. Mm. Right now it doesn't look like much, but later on this summer it's great. The building, the log cabin building, was built in 1976, something like that, as the visitor center. And has functioned mostly as a visitor center up until about 5 years ago. It was under contract with the city, operated by the Chamber of Commerce. And so they had the visitor center and a few things down here in the basement as a museum. Five years ago, I think it was, the Chamber gave up the contract. Another group formed as a nonprofit to operate it. And it is the Palmer Museum of History and Art.
And art.
And so we try to put on art displays every month, a different display of some kind, featuring local artists or art of the local area, anyway. And we try to acquire some pieces. We're slowly building a collection of art, funded primarily by Rasmussen. The history side of it is a collection of stuff that people have donated. For the most part, we haven't been able to go out and actively focus on acquiring stuff. Someday we hope to be able to do that, but right now we don't have the room to add lots of stuff. But what we have, we put together a display that at the moment is in disarray upstairs because we were getting new display cases which have not shown up yet. Consequently, the old cases already left, and the new ones haven't arrived, so much of my display is not up. But we've tried to illustrate and tell the story of people who have come to live in the valley. And with artifacts displays to help us illustrate, tell that story. In the springtime in particular, we have a lot of school kids, classes that come in, and so I tell them that story and talk about the tools and the artifacts that people used in those days, which is really kind of fun. I tell them that, you know, thousands of years ago, nobody lived in the valley because it was all full of ice. There was a great glacier that filled the whole valley. And then after the glacier melted away, then the first people in here were the Athabascan Indians. The two groups, the Dena'ina folks who came from the west and the Atna people who came down the Matanuska River. And then the Russians came in. They didn't settle here in the valley like they did down on the Kenai and elsewhere, but they were traders primarily. They did a little exploration. And then when the Russians sold their interest in Alaska to the U.S., then more traders came in to take their place. Trappers came in, prospectors, and the prospectors found gold and coal. And that brought more people in to mine the gold, build a railroad, get the coal, and then homesteaders started homesteading. Some of those old homesteaders were gold rush prospectors that didn't make it. Some of them, they'd winter down here in Kinnick, the little town of Kinnick, which was the center of the area at that time, because it wasn't as cold and and bitter as it was up in the interior. And some of them gave up prospecting and took up homesteading. And so so there were some people coming in here. And again, the story of the government wanted to figure out if agriculture was possible here so that settlement would be possible, be able to grow something to feed the people if you got them here. And then the colony came in behind that, and you know, here we are today, kind of thing. So we don't have enough room to show much of our collection. We have stuff back here, here and there, and all over. And
plans for a new building at all, or
There's no money. The city doesn't support it all that much, and nobody else is interested enough, I guess. But you know, there's always hopes and dreams. And so someday, my hope and dream is that someday this organization and the Historical Society, with its little museum and its collection, they have more stuff than we do, scattered all over the valley, stuffed in Connex units and basements and warehouses and people have stuff, their personal collections, that they would like to see in a museum, but until the museum can take it and take care of it and display it, they're not going to give it to us, you know, and we can't really ask them for it, except for photographs. I really promote trying to get photographs. One, because you don't have to give us the original. We can copy it and have the image, and you can keep the original. I make people a deal. You bring me your album in, and we'll copy the pictures that we want, and we'll make a CD for you so that you have it on a CD, and you can duplicate that for your kids and everybody if we can have the image in our collection. And photographs don't take up much space, you know. So I can collect a lot of pictures without having to find a place to put them.
How how long have you been? You're the executive director, right?
No. I'm just a flunky here. We have a board of directors, seven people, and the director is Selena Chilero, Selena Ortega Chilero.
Mm-hmm.
She has been with us, I think this is like her third year, maybe.
Oh.
Something like that. Very energetic lady. She keeps bringing stuff to the basement for me to find a place for. But it's interesting. We do collect a few things. Much of what I've been doing, I originally was hired to work for the visitor center side of it, and then just do some cataloging stuff in the wintertime here. My job has shifted to be all museum stuff, except as I happen to get to talking to people at the visitor center side, which is always fun. So what I've been doing is cataloging stuff, just organizing the stuff physically and in the catalog. When I first came to work here, you couldn't get off the bottom step here because the whole place was full. So a big part of the job is just organizing it.
Well, and cataloging it so that, you know, everybody knows what's here. It's a huge job.
Yeah.
It's collection management, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that's what I do now. And now that we've got the computer back up, I'm looking to see what we've lost in the... We use Past Perfect cataloging system.
Yes.
See what got lost and replace that. And,
right.
And then I've been... temporarily acquiring other stuff in the meantime. So as soon as I get this up and running, then I can get the collections committee to look at all that stuff and decide which we're going to keep and not. And then I can get that cataloged. It's fun. It's really interesting to me. We get an artifact, you know, with... Sometimes we have little information about it, sometimes we don't, you know. I found this in the attic, I don't know what it is, you know. But for me to find out what it is, or to track it down and research it and so on, is fun. That churn right there.
Uh-huh, looks like a butter churn.
It's a butter churn.
Yeah.
And I would put it in the catalog and then I wanted to find out more about it. So you get online, you know, and there's all kinds of antique collection sites and stuff. And so I found that on some site. And only through that did I discover there's a piece missing off of that.
Oh, my.
I had wondered as I was... looking at how it worked and, you know, took it apart, take pictures of it and so on, the handle kept falling off. I kept thinking, how in the world does this work if the handle won't stay in there? You know, because if you fill it full of cream and the handle comes off, it's going to leak and you can't reach inside to get the dasher and reattach it because it's full of clabbered milk in there. I couldn't figure that out until I discovered that there's a little key that locks the handle in place. Once you put it together, you put that little key on there, and the key's missing. So, having discovered that, then I've got to get back on one of these antique sites and find somebody who has a key for sale, and then get my director to let me buy the thing so I can put it together. So, anyway.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for all your time. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you.
Thank you for,
a pleasure.
For coming by.
Oh.
Well, I would like to suggest that.
Do you want me to turn?